Welcome to the Technori Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Catoon. Today's show is sponsored by ActiveCampaign. See why 65,000 businesses use ActiveCampaign for their marketing by signing up at ActiveCampaign.com/Technori and get your first 2 months for free. Great show today. The CMO, Chief Marketing Officer of Locust Robotics, Karen Levitt, is joining me on the show. And I'll just tell you the takeaway. First off, just the robotics world and where we've come in the last 20 years, I mean, century, but really, you know, 2 years and 20 years is insane. And there's a reason behind it that I don't think anyone's thinking about. I think people might think engineers are sitting in a lab coming up with, like, what could we do next with a piece of metal and some software? The reality is it's folks like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos at Amazon that are forcing, and I don't mean that in a negative way, it's actually quite positive, forcing the innovation. Jeff Bezos comes out and says, you know, if you buy with Amazon, you're going to get your package in 2 days, when previously it was a week. And before that, I mean, everyone assumed during the holiday season that if you bought something for Christmas, you better buy it in like October. Now it's 2 days. And then he said, oh, by the way, it's actually 1 day. And if you live in New York, it's actually in 2 hours. They didn't have the technology to do that. What happened was he would then pay to have his workforce working triple overtime to make sure they delivered this. Meanwhile, he bought a robotics company and developed not a replacement for humans, but an augmentation for humans. He bought a robotics company that could enable people to work alongside of machines that would basically reduce the amount of labor and make the labor more efficient, both cost and operational. And in doing so, he changed the way that you, the consumer, viewed or expected purchasing. You bought something and it was expected it's here tomorrow. I bought a runner rug so my dog could more easily jump on my bed yesterday, and I was actually a little pissed that it wasn't delivered on Sunday, by the way. It wasn't delivered. And that's just the way it is now. And a lot of that expectation and changing of consumer behavior is what leads to this rich innovation that is solving a problem we didn't know we had. We didn't care. Military people did, doctors did, because there's, you know, an actual, like, mission critical thing here. But the General Joe and Jane didn't. And so I think it's really fascinating to go back in time and understand why and how, you know, these pieces of technology and robotics are built. The other big takeaway is, hey, Alexa, please dock my iRobot. Because the future of everything is iRobot vacuums for everything. You say the Uber of this, I'm the iRobot of that. That's the future. And it's not a threat to people. I mean, it really isn't. It'll be a world where we're quickly heading towards a 24-hour work cycle for everything. And part of that's global economy, so it's still people to people. But having machines that basically dock at night or dock when they need to charge and then go back out to the workforce, creating a 24-hour work cycle, and then the human beings are sort of like Microsoft just did. They're testing the Friday work. They're basically reducing the labor intensiveness that humans need to do because it's just unnecessary. And of course, that will have ripple effects, and we didn't get into that. But I just think that the conversation around robotics, a lot of times everyone jumps right into the fascination of robots and not the fascination of the software. And as Karen very, very well states, robots are essentially a paperweight without the software. And she goes very deeply into the sort of, if you want to call it a revenue model, but the business model around Locust. And it was incredibly fascinating, and I think you will enjoy it. If you enjoy this podcast, you will undoubtedly enjoy a conversation with another robotics person I talked to, which is the CEO of Humatics, I believe also located in Massachusetts, David Mindell. And locally here, I got to give a quick shout out. The news ran out a week ago, but it's never too late. It's the last podcast I did since the news broke. Previous guest on the show, a good friend, Justin Howard of Sprout Social, the CEO, founder of Sprout Social. They announced that they're going to IPO. They filed their S-1 looking to raise $100 million. Chicago is becoming a quiet mecca for MarTech, and Justin and the team have done an absolutely incredible job. And the backstory of that business, very similar to our sponsor ActiveCampaign, is sensational. And so I just want to give a quick shout out to the Sprout Social team and Justin. So congratulations to you guys, and best of luck in the IPO. We will, of course, have Justin on to talk about it afterward. Justin, if you're listening to this, that's my invitation. All right, time to jump into the interview. This is the Chief Marketing Officer of Locust Robotics, Karen Levitt. So I'm going to start the show with kind of a funny adage. So I'm in the middle of catching up on a show, Billions. I don't know if you're familiar with this show, if it's a Showtime show. And my producer, Sam, has been telling me forever that I need to watch a show that the Axelrod character is, like, right up my alley. And
that's
so,
the Damian Lewis character, right?
Yes. And he, like, it. Yeah. I am, like, I'm so in right now that I'm dressing like him. I went to Nordstrom's Rack and picked up some clothing for my winter gear. I look everything like him, minus the Billions and the red hair. And that's me. And probably throw an extra, like, 30 pounds on me, but that's the other part. Ironically, yesterday I did a snow day with my little daughter, and I was ripping through some episodes, and the episode, the last one I saw, was the one where he decides he wants to get into a little bit of VC, and he goes and sits in on a robotics company. And so,
oh, really?
I thought it's such a perfect kind of adage. So I think it's interesting to me, you know, mostly the fact that the and this is, of course, the show is, what, you know, 3 or 4 years old. The advancement in robotics from when the show was recorded to now is so insanely advanced, in the sense that, like, they were trying to figure out how can we have these robots work alongside of people, and they were pitching this to government contracts and military use, and the robot could do everything. It was like, what do you call, RoboCop, all the way up until they threw some pens on the floor, and then the robot couldn't, you know, immediately tipped over. And I was just thinking, like, not that long ago, we were in a world where it was like, conceptually, robots could absolutely work alongside of us, but we hadn't quite gotten to this point where they were, you know, usable in a practical sense. And so I'm really excited to learn about what Locus is doing and the robots and the use case. And that's sort of the periphery. The real meat and potatoes of this conversation, I think, will dive into the ability for man to increase productivity with the access to robotics, similar to AI, rather than being viewed as a replacement. And there are certainly, you know, areas where replacements there, but right now I just see this world opening up where, you know, we can lift things we couldn't lift before, we could work faster, we could not do, you know, the repetitive tasks, we could be on, you know, sort of on autopilot with regard to some of these tasks, and the robots really can pick up the pace here. So I think maybe it's easier to set this up with just you giving us a rundown on Locus Robotics first, and then let's dive into all the cool stuff.
Okay, that sounds terrific. By the way, I have not seen Billions, but both my husband and my son have been trying to convince me to watch it, so now I'm going to have to look at it.
And
the
you have to.
Described,
you
the
have
scene
to.
You just described, it reminds me of that scene in Animal House where the character goes into the store and says, "I'd like 10,000 marbles, please." So I don't know if you remember Animal House,
and ironically enough, on my way in this morning, I was listening to the Mark Maron podcast with John Goodman. He was talking about the Animal House scene. So the all of these things are coming together in real time.
Right. So today, if we had 10,000 marbles on the floor of a warehouse, the robot would actually be able to avoid them. So
that's insane.
That's where, yeah, what you said from the very beginning was that things are moving so fast, and they are moving incredibly fast. So let me back up, and I'll give you an overview of who we are, what we do, why we do it, and then you can copy and paste at will. So we make robots. Locus Robotics makes autonomous mobile robots. Sometimes we call them AMRs, that are designed for a specific purpose. They're designed to work in a fulfillment warehouse. So what does that mean? Whenever you order something online and it gets shipped to your home or your office, the item that you're ordering lives in a warehouse, and typically the raw materials of how that gets to you is human labor. A human being is literally walking through a warehouse armed with what's essentially a glorified shopping cart, and they get an order to go pick something, and they trudge all the way through the aisles to get to the place where your item is located. They put it in their cart, they take it to a packing station where it's wrapped up and shipped to your home. And that business, as you can imagine, has grown dramatically in the last decade. I mean, really, if you think about it, the start of the 21st century was really the start of the e-commerce era. And we've been seeing roughly 10 to 12% CAGR, compound annual growth rate, year over year of online commerce, of e-commerce, as a larger and larger proportion of retail sales. So, and it's still just a small fraction of all of retail. It's still only less than 20% of all retail. So as you've been seeing stores close in your local malls, that's because there's been this shift over to more direct-to-consumer shipping. And getting the merchandise from the warehouse into the hands of the consumers is highly labor-intensive. So, you know, if you think about it, when you go and shop in a retail store, you're doing a lot of work for the retailer. You drive yourself there, you walk through the aisles of the store, you select your item off the rack, you take it to the checkout counter, and then after you pay for it, you take it home with you. And as the consumption of goods has shifted upstream, so it's going direct to consumer, the burden of many of those tasks now falls to the warehouse operator. And that has put a tremendous demand for labor on, fill in the blank, on retailers, on all purveyors of merchandise, that has really strained the industry. It's very difficult for people to find the labor to do those tasks. And so it was only natural to introduce automation to help with that.
Can I jump in for a second?
Yes, of course, I've been talking.
You're hitting on something that I just think is, it is, this is one of those moments where, for listeners, where you, like, things come together. And I don't think that the average consumer, and obviously they have other things to think about. They don't need to think about how their goods get to their door. But it's worth noting that if you look at Amazon, and this is sort of like the Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos kind of comparison that I make fairly frequently on the Instagram shows that we do, but rarely, because they're just so different people. I try to avoid the entrepreneur comparison game. But for this case, Jeff Bezos basically changed expectations for all of your consumers by saying, we're going to deliver things to you not only next day, but like today. We're going to move things today. And he basically set a line in the sand and then said, I don't really know how we're going to fulfill it right now. We're just going to do our best. And that's why we're not charging for the upgrades. And it's sort of like, you know, you get what you want. But we are going to innovate our company and invest in technologies with all of the massive amounts of revenue that they generate into things that will one day be easy peasy for us to fulfill our promises. And they're like very, very rarely in the history of the economy, at least in the U.S. economy, but we might as well go global, have we had a problem that we didn't have. Because no one was griping about, I mean, you complain about your mailman, but you don't complain about that you had to wait 4 or 5 days. I mean, it was expected if I ordered something for Christmas that I better do it, you know, in like October. Like, that was just assumed. And so no one was running around saying, oh my God, I've got to be next day or today. Otherwise, it's just not going to be, you know, I'm not going to be happy. He was a person who decided, very similar to Elon Musk with electric cars, we are going to do it this way in perpetuity, and we're not doing it yet, and you don't even know you want it, but I'm going to give it to you anyway. And then it's our job to figure it out. And in doing so, the amount of money and the amount of jobs that are created just trying to keep up with a promise as simple as we'll deliver this tomorrow. It funds drone companies. It funds robotics companies. It funds logistics companies. It's forcing some of the largest sectors in the world to up their game and spend more on tech and develop new things. And I just think it's really fascinating, and people probably don't think of it and understand exactly how much pressure that puts on the locus robotics of the world to be like, oh, there's an opportunity here. We can develop this. And then, oh, look, we did this. We can do that. I just think this is one of those monumental times in history where we have sort of enough technology, but not quite enough technology to fulfill things we couldn't imagine 15 years ago, or things that we put in sci-fi movies as kind of a joke. And now mm-hmm. we're there, and it's allowing us to think of other applications and other uses that never would have even been there. And that's where I think, like, why I'm so excited to learn more about your company, because you guys are on that cutting edge of, like, look, peering through the window of things that we as consumers are not even, it's not even on my radar. And I think you hit on it just so well when you explain, you know, the pressure it puts on retail labor.
Yeah.
It's just crazy to me. So sorry to interrupt. It was just something you said. It was just amazing.
Great. In fact, you've hit the nail on the head. We actually, in the industry, we have a term for that. We call it the Amazon effect. And it's just exactly as you've described it. If you were sitting in a room with me, I'd be showing you some slides which show that, you know, what warehouses used to look like is warehouses used to be big boxes that contained a lot of pallets, and there were crates or cartons sitting on the pallets. And in order to move merchandise through the supply chain, you just needed a few workers and some fork trucks, and they would pick up the pallets and they would move them onto trucks and they would go out to distribution centers or retail stores, and that was it. And then now what you have in these warehouses, instead of closed crates of bulk merchandise, you have open bins. And what happens is people do what's called piece picking or each picking, the word each, like they pick each one. And it means that as I described to you earlier, a worker who is literally called a picker, that's their role to do fulfillment in the warehouse. And they take their cart, they push it through, and they pick one item out of a storage bin. They're not picking a whole case of a dozen or 24 or whatever. They're literally picking one item out of there. Maybe they'll pick two pairs of socks, but they might pick, you know, one toy car or one stapler. So it could be anything. It's not just consumer goods, by the way. Of course, there are B2B e-commerce items as well, with office supplies, medical
cars
devices,
even Carvana. I mean, that's very
cars,
similar.
Yes, one of our customers is a large global auto manufacturer, and we're picking auto parts.
Yep.
But what happened is, because you now have these individual bins, instead of just needing a few workers with a fork truck, you need to have this sort of small army of workers in the warehouse picking this merchandise. And then you've got exactly what you were describing, which is this Amazon effect, where Amazon raised consumer expectations. They set the bar and said, hey, consumer, what if instead of getting things in 5 to 7 days, you could get it guaranteed in 2 days for anything you order? And also, wouldn't you like it gift wrapped or with a note card in it? Oh, and by the way, remember we told you 2 days? You can actually have it in 1 day. Or if you live in a large metropolitan area like New York City, you can have it in 2 hours. How does that sound, consumer?
I'll take it.
And exactly. And so, as you said, customers got things that they didn't know they needed. But now that they have it, they're not giving it back. And
well, it's
so,
completely reshaped the shopping experience. And in a lot of ways, we talk about, you mentioned the Amazon effect. We talk about this, you know, with retail, right? And how, you know, it's eaten up so much retail, brick and mortar. And I also, a lot of times when we get these arguments, people will push negatively at Amazon and say, you know, they've ruined our local mom and pop. And the reality is, what they did for mom and pop is really not, I mean, it's novel when it happened, but it's not really novel. You can have Shopify, you can deliver stuff, like mm-hmm. that's fine. What they really did is they spoiled rotten the consumer. And the consumer is now the one who's ruining mom and pop, because their expectations are that they're going to have 2 hour delivery on, you know, a new Dyson humidifier. And that's just not, like, that's unrealistic for anyone who doesn't have the investment in robotics and automation and just, you know, the access. And that, you know, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, they may have ruined some mom and pops. They've certainly reshaped it. The yeah. landscape is
ruin
different.
Is overstating it.
They certainly ruined some. But in some cases, they've actually breathed new life into mom and pop and into artisanal businesses.
Yes.
People who didn't have the ability to open a storefront, you know, may have been able to sell things on eBay or Etsy, but now they can create a virtual storefront on someplace like Amazon, or they can use Shopify to set up a virtual store, and they can certainly store and fulfill their merchandise out of their garage. Sure, but if their business starts to get bigger, they can then have it stored online. So what's really cropped up in the last decade or so, we've seen just a burgeoning of businesses that we call 3PLs, third-party logistics
yep.
companies. And that has led to the blossoming of digital native brands. So there are some brands that never had a retail presence, were never sold through a reseller. You know, I think of a brand like Bonobos, which is a men's clothing line, and that is strictly a digital native brand. It was purchased by Walmart a couple of years ago. But or we look at Glossier Cosmetics or Away Suitcases.
As a random intersection, I actually had brunch this Saturday with Andy, the co-founder of Bonobos' sister,
oh, really?
Monica, who runs Monica and Andy, which is a digital first brand retail store. So, like, you were inside of my life, like you have no idea.
Well, you know, that's what's happening, and it really fits the lifestyle of people at every stage of their life cycle. You know, the convenience that's been created where you can essentially drop ship things to yourself. I can't tell you, you know, how many times I've ordered something online and have it shipped to where I'm going to be so that I can have sort of just-in-time consumption of the merchandise I get. I'll do this for everything from personal events, personal things to business things where I might have something
clothing for events that I'm going to be traveling and I don't want to carry all this stuff. I do it all the time.
Or to a trade show to order supplies for a trade show. And when my son was younger and was playing youth baseball, was playing on a travel team, I would order merchandise to have it arrive at the hotel I was going to be staying at, you know, in Tennessee. You can really, it's kind of like what we used to do with TV, and we would call it what was it called? Time switching or time shifting?
Time shifting, yep.
And now we have sort of we can do this with tangible items, where we can have we can have products shifting, where things can just be where you need them to be and meet you somewhere in three-dimensional space.
It's funny to wrap a bow on that. I mean, I think. It's just so crazy because the context of where we started this conversation around physical items and moving around a warehouse, you know, Technori as a brand was something that the brand was not digital. It was, we would come to this event, it was a Technori event, and that was the whole thing. And now, because of the shift in consumer behavior and the understanding of brand and digital first brands, we've become a digital first brand. We now offer service lines mm-hmm. using building technology for people, investing in companies. Like, you know us through a digital brand, and that wouldn't even be possible either, because the consumers that we talk to would just be so, it would be too foreign to them. And I would even go, not to dive down this rabbit hole, but like you were talking about how there are different artisanal brands that exist now and they're better for it. You could argue that the opportunity of a lifetime that was missed is Toys R Us, because they stayed in the old way of a box and just had a bunch of stuff there. They could have built an experience for kids there. And it would have differentiated from the Amazon delivery. You could have come here and bought all kinds of the wall candy stuff, which keeps their doors open, and played with the toys, and then ordered it from, you know, ordered it over from Amazon or wherever, from Toys R Us online, whatever it is.
No, you're absolutely
so much opportunity.
Right. Because look what somebody like Apple has done by creating a real shopping experience.
Oh my God, yes.
Where you go in there and you are, it's more than just a shopping experience. It's a way to spend your time. And of course it's multi-generational, but you're absolutely right, because Toys R Us, you know, particularly when my kids were little and now that my grandkids are little, it's exactly the sort of place where they should want to get me in the door, but you get in, you know, toward the end of the life, you want to just get in, find what you needed, and get the heck out,
yep,
right?
Yep.
And
bad design.
So, anyway, so to kind of circle back around, so now everything's been pushed back upstream into the warehouse, and it's the warehouse operator who now has responsibility for making sure you get your merchandise, and not only just get your merchandise, but get your merchandise in a way that preserves all of the brand values. So when you ship something from Bonobos, you're going to want to make sure that it's in Bonobos packaging with Bonobos inserts that's really preserving that sort of, cool millennial feel to the brand. When you're ordering cosmetics, you want them to come with the right wrappings, any kind of upsell or promotional inserts, samples, things like that.
Yep.
And so the merchandise lives in warehouses, and in order for the warehouses to operate efficiently, they have sophisticated software, generally, kind of broadly referred to as WMS or warehouse management system software, and it is processing orders, taking, interfacing with whatever shopping cart application you have. It's sifting through orders, and it's also helping you control where you're going to place the merchandise in your warehouse. Most of it is sort of randomly put away to take, to wherever is the first available open space. So you don't have things neatly clustered in the warehouse where you have, all of the lipsticks in one area and all of the powder brushes in another. They're just put away wherever is available when they come in, so that you're able to, it's like a game of Tetris that the warehouse operator plays to make sure that merchandise is stored as efficiently and densely as possible.
Before we get into the robot part of this, which I am excited to learn about, I just want to tell you, this is going to be one of those podcasts that I point all of my friends to at this exact, the last like 7 minutes, really like the whole show, but the last 7 minutes, when they ask me why I do what I do, why do you spend your time talking to entrepreneurs and cutting edge companies and then invest? Like, what, it seems like you're playing poker all day. And I will tell you, this is the reason, because when I look at what you guys are doing, and I look at, like, let's use Tenants and big box as our play field here. Amazon is the big box. They're the big name in the room that moves people and changes behaviors. And then there's mm-hmm. companies like you that enable those behaviors to become real and then create new innovations that then Amazon begins chasing after or buys. And then in the meantime, there are companies out there that are impacted that the world has never heard of, like industrial tape and strapping businesses that no longer are building tools that are helping the process, because these people need, they used to just have a pallet and unwrap it and rewrap it. And now they need to get into the pallet in the middle of it. In fact, it's not even a pallet. So the ability for me as an investor to see this and draw the dots together, I'm like, all right, so can we invest in a strapping company and help them stay innovative? Can we invest in someone like you? Do we buy market share of Amazon? There are so many moving pieces, and it is the most exciting thing on the planet, because it's literally like looking into a crystal ball, and you just hope that, what you see is real, from the investor standpoint. From the buyer standpoint, they get to find out in real time.
Yeah, well, that's true. And so I'm going to break that down just a little bit. First of all, the market is huge and it's global. It's people who buy stuff. So, we're talking about, in terms of the underlying market we serve, that is e-commerce or warehouse fulfillment, it's a multi-trillion dollar market worldwide. And then we look at the markets, because it's by no means a homogeneous market worldwide. The problems shift from one geography to another based on the availability and cost of raw materials. And if you remember what I said earlier, the raw material in this market is human labor.
Yep.
So in markets where you have plentiful human populations and I'm making this sound very, you know, very sort of antiseptic, and I don't mean to, but where you have, we have large populations of workforce and low wages, then it's still more efficient to use humans in that instance, at least more economical to use humans than to use automation. But so many of the top economies in the world, because their economies are doing so well, are facing labor shortages. And when you can get the labor, the wage rates are very high. And at that point, the automation becomes a critical catalyst to the further growth of the business. When we look at a business like Amazon, you're right, Amazon is, of course, the 800-pound gorilla. More than a third of all e-commerce in North America last year was through Amazon. So they are really controlling the tides in the space. We are not, our solution is not employed by Amazon, and about seven years ago, Amazon bought a company that was a robotics company, which sort of kicked off this arms race.
Yep.
Amazon bought a company, also a Massachusetts company, and they took it private. They brought it inside, and they stopped selling it on the open market. And so it's now exclusively used by Amazon. They call it Amazon Robotics. And that created quite a ripple in the industry. So they created this arms race. And from our perspective, we're an arms dealer. We are selling this critical technology that allows companies to be able to compete to all those businesses who aren't Amazon. And there are some very big players there. And they're not just doing e-commerce for consumers. As I said, they're doing B2B. We have companies that are picking medical devices so that if you needed a hip replacement or a knee replacement, that, you know, the right size and spec hip would come out of a warehouse and get shipped to a hospital to meet you on the operating table at 8:30 tomorrow morning. And so some of these are really mission critical services that are happening there, and being able to turn those orders around in a way that's in some cases more than just convenient, but actually mission critical, is part of what we're enabling.
No, I totally. And that doesn't even mention the fact that Alibaba sold $38 billion worth of goods about a day ago.
You know, little of Singles Day.
Oh, yes. My God. I didn't even know that was a thing. I miss most of the world. No, you're making a great point, and I think it really does tie out, because as you recall early on in this conversation, you mentioned the ability for all of these artisanal and other brands to utilize things like the third party, you know, shipper in Spotify or whatever, and Shopify. And that whole component is probably never going to be less than, let's just say, like end of days style. It's like 30% of the market, which is still insane. Like, even if Amazon ate up half the market, there's still literally half of the world that you can address it. The serviceable market is almost as big as the total addressable market, which is insane.
From an automation perspective, the wage rates in different places on the planet, though, can dramatically affect whether deploying the automation is a sensible thing to do. So here in the U.S., where the wage rates of an average warehouse picker fully loaded get to be close to $40,000 a year, a comparable role someplace in, say, Southeast Asia might be only, say, $15,000 a year. And at that point, the economics of using the robotics technology may not yet fit the market. It's not to say they won't, but today with the current supply chain, it's not quite there. But it means that there is sort of a logical deployment path where, you know, we've started to roll out our robots first in North America. Now we're deploying in Europe, and then we're targeting markets for deployment based on where the math makes sense for our customers.
Totally makes sense.
And it's a business of math. It's really a very ROI-driven business. And the good news is there's some terrific ROI.
Yeah, that's probably an understatement. I think, I look at this as it's a something in the past. We probably wouldn't have looked at it this way, but now this is like 1A, 1B in logistics. You don't have the logistics pieces that we have today without this integrated into it. And there's other bolt-ons that will come in time, and that's just one use case. There's, of course, many others. I'd love to know, since we're this is an audio show, so we don't have the video component, I would love to know what the experience is like, what the robots do, what they look like, what they feel like.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because I think it's important to sort of pull back the curtain and kind of bust some of the myths around robots. First, they're not going to steal anybody's job. They are actually these are collaborative robots. So let me try and build a picture of the robot in the minds of your viewers. The first thing I want your viewers to think about is a self-driving car. These robots are essentially self-driving cars that operate indoors in a warehouse. And their technology, their software, is really designed to anticipate that the environment is going to look and operate like a warehouse. And that's a loaded term. There are a lot of moving parts to that, quite literally. But so we've got this self-driving car, but it doesn't look like a car that you or I would get into and drive. Not only that, but it doesn't look like sort of the science fiction view of robots. This is not Rosie the robot from the Jetsons.
Yeah.
It's really purpose-built to handle the task at hand, which is to operate in the fairly densely populated world of the warehouse. So what does that mean? It means that it has to be very nimble. It has to be sized in a way that it can navigate aisles that may not be all that wide. Typically, we like to see 5-foot wide aisles, but then they can become quite congested with people, with ladders, with merchandise that's been, sort of haphazardly placed someplace. And the robots need to be able to deal with the dynamically changing nature of their environment all the time. So the robots are making decisions 10 times a second about where they're going to be and how they're going to get there and what obstacles might be in their way. And often those obstacles are going to be human obstacles. So the robots also have to be very polite, very safe, very gentle, and very collaborative. So the robot and the human become a team working together to achieve the end of getting merchandise from the warehouse into the hands of the consumers who've ordered it. And the trick there is to divide up the tasks so that the robot is doing what robots do best, which is doing lots of travel and lots of carrying of merchandise. And they're not only carrying merchandise, but they're also carrying instructions for their human coworkers. Now, what humans do best is humans have fantastic manual dexterity. So humans today are the best suited at pulling merchandise out of a bin, placing it into a robot. And what we want to do is we want the humans to be making as many of those picking and placing tasks as possible. As the more a human can do of those in an hour, the better the economics for the warehouse. That's really sort of where the money is for the warehouse operator. If the human worker, if the person, we can call them people, they're people, but if the people are spending most of their time walking from one pick to another, the warehouse operator doesn't have a very effective economic model, because the warehouse operator is getting paid based on what gets picked and shipped out the door. So what you want is you want your workers to be spending as much of their time as possible making picks, and you want to minimize what we call time off task, doing walking or sort of figuring things out. And that's where the robots come in. So the robots get integrated with the warehouse management system that's running the facility. And they're not a passive extension of the WMS. The robots are very actively doing their own calculations to understand, okay, there are 1,000 orders waiting to be picked in this warehouse. What are the next 6 orders I should plan to pick that are going to optimize the density of work? So the robot system, which is robots, by the way, are roughly 90% software. You look at them and they look like they're made of aluminum and plastic and so forth. But most of what goes on that makes a robot is the software. And so the software is looking at the pool of orders and deciding, how am I going to optimize the work here? I'm going to choose orders that are physically, with merchandise in them, that's physically located as close as possible to one another in the warehouse. So I'm not going to take the orders serially. I'm going to dip into that pool and pick orders where the goods are located close together. I'm going to pick as many orders as I can carry on one robot. So if I'm picking cosmetics, for example, I might be able to get 15 orders onto one robot. If I'm picking, puffer jackets, I might only be able to get 2 orders onto a robot. So a lot of this depends on the type of merchandise being picked. But I want to maximize that density. And then when I pick the orders, I want to pick orders that are located as close as possible to where I know a human worker already is, because I want to bring work to the worker. And that's something that, from a locus perspective, that's a uniquely locus perspective and skill set. The idea of bringing that work to the workers and not just having the workers look for robots and move around is part of what really soups up the workers' productivity. And in the final analysis, what our robots do is they make people more productive. They make people twice or even as much as 3 times more productive than they are without robots. And that's how the robots earn their keep. And then what we do is we put it together in a business model that really makes sense for the customers. This was a real breakthrough in the industry. Most people who are selling automation into warehouses charge for it sort of as if you're buying a truck or a forklift. They sell it to you as a capital expense, and we don't do that. We make this. We offer robots as a service. So it's a subscription model, and what you're essentially doing is you're paying your robots a salary. So you now have your worker population consists of human workers and robot workers, and you're paying all of your workers a salary so that the wages that you save by requiring fewer workers, but you can't get anyway, right? Yep. Are spent on robots who are earning a robot wage. And that makes the math really, sing for our customers.
I can imagine why. Honestly, I think it's the whole thing is very novel, and I completely agree with everything you said with regard to why doing this sort of robot as a service matters. I think it's one of the biggest mistakes that probably has ever happened to some of the early movers in the space, because they treated it like you were buying a box of iPhones. Mm-hmm. And it was like, oh, when the iPhones break, you send it back. We send a person who comes in and they fix it or whatever has been done. It's like, it's a hunk of metal. Like, there are things that will break, obviously, but it's a hunk of metal. It's useless. It's a paperweight unless the software is proper for it and it works with you. And the really funny thing is, you said this without saying it, but this is we've been at it for a while, but this is truly a global economy in the sense that we have, as a company, I employ real people. I employ freelancers, local. Mm-hmm. I employ outsourced offshore technology development. I use several AI software pieces for whether it's for email, automation of some of our social media stuff. If I ever am in the business of having a robot that can come in and produce the show or whatever, I would employ them. And I think you are dead on when you say when the CEOs and the financial, the CFOs step back and they have to look at this, especially for public companies that have to put their financials out there for a market for people to invest in. it makes life a hell of a lot easier if I'm not writing down capital debts and other, you know, capital assets that we have, rather than just looking at it like, well, our workflow and work staff cost, you know, it's a cost of goods served. Like, this is what it costs. This is what we pay to get something done. It just makes the math lay flat. Whereas in the past, you had to sit there and explain like why you invested in this random paperweight that was the size of, you know, a human or a car. And so I think where you guys are at, it's just super, super cutting edge, in my opinion.
Thank you. And, you know, it becomes even more compelling when you take into account something that you alluded to, which is the fact that on a seasonal basis, your need for labor and consequently your need for automation varies dramatically. So we're heading into many of our customers' peak seasons. If you're doing e-commerce to consumers in the U.S., you're about to get, you know, you're hitting your make or break season. Your order volume can go up by 10 or 15x versus your low period in the summer. And for most customers, it's probably 4 or 5x what your average steady state rate is year round. So what does that mean? That means that you're certainly going to have to hire some temporary workers, and that's true whether you're using automation or not. But you also need to know that your robot population, your automation technology, is going to be able to scale up and scale down as your business needs change as well. Or else, as you said, you bought that paperweight, and it's sitting there whether you need it or not. So we actually, over the course of the last few weeks, have shipped out about close to 500 robots that are seasonal surge robots to our customers. And these are robots that are going out into the world to existing customer sites of ours. In some cases, they're increasing those on-site robot populations by as much as 50%. And they'll be there for 60 days, and then they're going to come back home. And our customers, you know, pay a premium in the wages that they pay the robots for the short period of time. But it's predictable. It's anticipated as part of the original spec in the customer subscription. The robots go out there. They do their job. They come back. And then the warehouse life continues as it goes into the post-holiday, you know, step down. And that's what people need. When you boil it all down, yes, we're selling robots as a service, but we're really selling flexibility as a service. And that's what this industry really demands.
Totally. Very well said. I guess what would be the last thing I'd ask for you guys is the future. For me, I don't obviously see the inside of this. The future seems so ridiculously unlimited. And I look at this and I think, all I'm envisioning as you describe this is my iRobot that's sitting in my house, hopefully cleaning. Yeah. It's Tuesday. It should be doing vacuuming right now. I walk in and I say, Alexa, please dock my iRobot. And if I'm the surveyor, if I'm the head engineer at any of these warehouses, I'm going to walk in and say, probably not Alexa, but maybe it's Watson or whoever it is. Watson, please dock all of our shift workers. And they basically all scoot back into the trailer and they plug themselves in. And you guys service them and replace them as time goes on. And they upgrade as the technology becomes available, very similar to my car. And ultimately, they're paying for your software and your R&D. That's what they're paying you for.
That's exactly right. The only difference is they don't have to tell the robots to go plug in.
Oh, yeah, I was obviously
joking
there.
Robots are automatically heading to chargers when they get thirsty and putting themselves back out on the floor. This time of year, we have a number of customers who are actually running 3 full shifts, so they're running around the clock. And so the robots will take a sip of juice whenever there's a little bit of a lull, to make sure that they're operating around the clock. But yes, if there comes a point where the warehouse gets shut down at the end of the night, then, you know, the warehouse operator says, you know, that'll do, bot. And the robots will head over to the charging stations. And there's a ratio of charging stations to robots. So robots will go on, they'll charge. When they're done, they'll step away, and other robots will take their place. So they're always working to make sure that they're staying, you know, fully charged, sort of hand rested and ready to get the job done.
This has been great. I really do sincerely appreciate you taking all the time, and I enjoyed this conversation very much.
Yeah, as did I. Thanks so much,
awesome.
Scott.
Thanks,
really
Karen.
Appreciate your time.
Have a wonderful
Talk
week. If you have any questions or topics you'd like me to discuss, DM me on Instagram at Technori or at Katoon. To invest in featured startups or apply to pitch on the Startup Showcase live on WGN Radio, go to technori.com. Boom, that's a wrap.